The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan
on News Talk.
You're welcome back to The Hard Shoulder. Kieran Cuddihy with you until 7 o'clock. And I am delighted to be joined for the Thursday interview this week by Sinéad Gleeson, the author. I'm sure lots of you will have read Constellations over the last couple of years. I'm holding in my hand her latest work. This Woman's Work is the name of it, Essays in Music. And it was edited by Sinéad alongside Kim Gordon. And actually, because this speaks to, I suppose, maybe the idea behind this book. Who is Kim Gordon, Sinéad?
Well, Kim Gordon was actually one of my heroes, is one of my heroes. And she was in a band that a lot of people might know called Sonic Youth. They played very kind of noisy punk rock American sort of band who were very big in the 80s and 90s. And they, I loved them. And they came to play in Dublin in McGonagall's. I don't know if you remember McGonagall's. It was off South Ann Street and a tiny, sweaty, I would say, venture to say fire hazard type of venue.
Yeah.
Went to see them play there and I was about 15 and, you know, it was loud and noisy and sweaty and crazy and it was just unbelievable. But there was a moment in the cube outside, and again, part of the reason for the book is, you know, a lot of the time I went to gigs then, I was obsessed with music. There weren't a lot of girls in the audience. So I was waiting outside in this gigantic queue, you know, one of a handful of women, and the tour bus was outside and Kim got off, you know, came out of the venue, went to get something off the bus. And there was a moment where I looked at her, and maybe it was because I was maybe one of the few girls in the queue. She sort of looked at me and I looked at her, and she claims she remembers this now. I'm not sure that she does. But I saw them play, and then they played a year later with Nirvana as a support when like Nirvana's first gig, nobody really knew who they were, but I was buying my records from Sub Pop directly. And one of the CEO of Sub Pop is actually in this book, Megan Jesper, who claims she remembers sending my records to Dublin. But I just kept an eye on her career. She's, you know, Sonic Youth, there's the solo stuff, and then she came to Dublin about 3 years ago. She is an artist, and I mean, like a lot, like, you know, Dave Byrne, Bowie, a lot of musicians went to art school, and so did Kim. So she was making art before she was making music. And we were put together on this kind of panel. I was asked to interview her, and very coincidentally, she was going to London the next day, and she had written a memoir herself about music called Girl in a Band. And it's called that because she was constantly getting asked, what's it like to be a girl in a band? And her editor is a man called Lee Brackstone, who runs this publishing house, White Rabbit. And he said to her, I'd love you to do a book of music on essays. And, you know, would you be up for it? And she said, I don't really have the editorial experience, but I just met this woman in Dublin. She's edited some anthologies. We got on really well. She likes music. Maybe she'd do it with me. So, I mean, you don't really say no to Kim working with Kim Gordon. So that was how it came about.
So meet your heroes is the lesson.
I definitely think so. She's brilliant. And you know, we did an event together in the US with Laurie Anderson, who's the subject of the first essay in the book, and who's again a bit of a, you know, a maverick and an auteur herself. And she's actually going to be at this Boris Festival too. But it was just, you know, sitting with Laurie Anderson and Kim Gordon on one side of you, it's just, it doesn't get more sort of pinch me than that. But two really iconic women who would have been, you know, doing it at a time when it was a good bit harder to be a woman in music. There was a lot more barriers and a lot more obstacles and a lot more dodginess, I think, went on that we all seem to know about and talk about now. But yeah, really, both really iconic in different ways.
So for people at home, I mean, is the book then about overcoming those barriers, or is it about changing the perceptions we have about women in music and maybe the pigeonholes that they're meant to, or the moles that they're meant to occupy?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was very much the thinking behind the book. And I mean, it's a collection of essays, and I think I've written essays myself, and it's a very sort of bendy, malleable form. You can do an awful lot with it. And I think we didn't give everybody a brief. We just said, think about something you feel really strongly about that's connected to music. That might be one person. It might be a person you know in real life. It might be a genre, song, an album. And everybody wrote really different things. So I think what comes across, and I think the reason the book exists is that when you think about the music book or the music memoir, you think about, you know, the big books, the you know, Bob Dylan's Chronicles, or, you know, all those kind of music memoirs, or I'm, you know, with the Motley Crue, you know, The Dirt, or there's a lot of like very iconic sort of music books, but a lot of them are very male dominated, and they're about telling one story, a single story, a chronological story of someone's life in music. And these essays are not necessarily that. Some people wrote about people who are well known, but often came at it from a very specific sort of angle.
But when you say those books you mentioned that they are male dominated, is that that's a reflection of the industry, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that this publisher, White Rabbit, Lee Braxton, had been at Faber for years. He did a book of lyrics with Kate Bush. He did a book with Viv Albertine from The Slits. He did Kim's memoir. And I think he brought that, he knew when he set up White Rabbit, we had a conversation that the first few books they published were all by men. And I said to him, you know, you've really got to look at that. And he said, I know, it's in hand. So six or seven of the books they've published this year have all been by women. They've published an amazing amount. And again, people, you know, DJs, people who were famous in folk music, Vashti Bunyan, who was a folk singer in the 70s and literally disappeared, Shirley Johnson, the journalist Jude Rogers, who writes about music for The Guardian. So all different kinds of people. And I think, yeah, you're right. The gatekeepers would have had a lot to answer for in terms of who gets. But then that happens in all, it's not just music. It's like, you know, who do we hold up as the best examples of an industry? And often, sometimes that's not necessarily women, even though some of those stories are the most interesting because there's more to overcome. I mean, I mentioned Vashti Bunyan. You know, she disappeared for 40 years and came back with a second album 40 years later because she'd encountered so much sexism. She'd also was trying to raise a family. She moved around a lot. She didn't have a lot of money. And there's loads of barriers to kind of getting into any industry. And I think sometimes it's trickier for women, not just women, all kind of people who would be considered, you know, a bit more on the outside. So I think the book goes to some way towards telling some of the stories. And I think lots of us, you know, you could, my own piece in the book, I was, you know, it's the tyranny of choice. There's a million people I could have written about. Yeah. I deliberately picked somebody who was kind of obscure because, you know, when you find an essay about anything and it's, a golfer or a person who lives in a tiny town or somebody who wants to live in the woods. Like I love kind of finding out about something that hasn't already been well travelled and done to death. So I kind of tried to do that. And I think a lot of people in the book did that because that's a common thing we're hearing from readers is that a lot of people are like, I didn't necessarily know about this person. I wouldn't it wouldn't be the kind of person I necessarily would have heard their music. But now I'm, you know, running around on Spotify, going on a YouTube deep dive, looking up clips to find out more about them. Yeah. And that's what a good piece of writing should make you do. It should make you more curious and make you want to find out more.
I really like the Fatima Bhutto story. Yeah. You know what I mean? And just in Syria, growing up in Syria, and the kind of the mood in the house being dictated by what was maybe happening at home, as it were, in Pakistan, and then that mood manifesting itself in musical choices. Yeah, Good News meant Elvis was played.
Absolutely. And her father, I mean, she talks about, like, people probably know about the dictatorship, and her father was in exile. Her father obviously
This is Benazir Bhutto's daughter.
Yeah. So Benazir Bhutto was her aunt, and then her
niece, yeah.
Yeah. So her father was So the idea is that he was in exile and he spent all his time playing the music in the house, that, you know, and including like Otis Redding sitting on the dock of the bay because it reminded him of being home. So she writes a lot in that essay about she'd never been to Pakistan as a child because they were in exile and they moved around an awful lot, I think, for safety reasons. And she said that I became obsessed with the country through my dad reminiscing about it through song that I'd never even been in. So you can feel a sadness through a place you've never been. And I think, you know, obviously her Benazir Bhutto was very much implicated in her father's murder, which she writes about in the book as well. But even all the time through upheaval and sadness, music is kind of a constant. She talks in separately about how people have used music politically, you know, smuggling political songs out of secret recordings that, you know, and we know in Ireland, I mean, so many songs in Ireland have big political meanings as well. So there's a very public and political element to music as well. Yeah. So there's a very private one when you're listening on your own or with your headphones on or whatever. So they're two very distinct things.
To come back to Kim Gordon, and I mean, that question that she used to get, I mean, what's it like being, you know, a girl in a band?
Yeah.
I suppose, is that there's still maybe this subconscious idea that when you see a girl in a band, as it were, that they're kind of, there's something alien about it? You know what I mean? That this is someone who's kind of straight into another world that they don't necessarily belong in.
Well, I think that's changed an awful lot. And even if you look at like Irish music now, I mean, the likes of Pillow Queens and CMAT and Soak, there's loads of people making massive inroads in it. And I think I did a panel at the Hate Festival this week. There was a neuroscientist on with us who was talking about how memory affects the brain. And she used to be in a band. And she said, you know, people always assumed when I said I was in a band that I was a singer, you know, that I wasn't technical. I wasn't the guitarist. I wasn't the bassist. I was the backing singer.
You're the lovely voice.
Or you're the girl. Or you're the front girl. You're the eye candy. That kind of thing. So I think there was always misconceptions about what you might have done within a band. I think that's a very realistic thing, but it has changed. And I think the more when you have books like this, it kind of makes people aware that there are lots of stories that we don't get to hear, and that's often down to editors, publishers, magazine editors. You look at music magazines. I mean, I wrote about music for a long time, and when I was doing it, there really weren't many women doing it. It's changed a lot now. You know, the internet has democratized who has a voice. Everybody's doing things on TikTok or posting on Twitter. But yeah, I think, and again, whether that's journalism or whether that's Kim in a band, it's like, if you don't feel that, if you don't see it, you can't be it. But thankfully, that's a lot better. At the same time, you know, you see the ongoing conversations about, you know, playlists on national radio here and the lack of women in them, and then, or festival bills where you're scouring down and down the list till you find the first band with a woman in it. So there's still, you know, things are changing, but there's still a lot of things to be done.
Given the timing of publication, was this a lockdown project? Did this happen during
lockdown? God, yeah, it did. I mean, we'd met in that July, and then we'd started to work and we're waiting for the work to come in. So all the essays started to come in while I was, you know, at home, kids. And if I never have to do Zoom again or figure out Microsoft Teams for my kids' schools, it'd be too soon. But I think my choice was sort of a little bit dictated by the lockdown. I picked a woman called Wendy Carlos, who's a film composer, very, very obscure, who'd worked with Bob Moog on his famous Moog synthesizers, and they wouldn't be the equipment they are now without her genius. Like, her degree was music and physics. But she's very famous for she wrote the opening scene to The Shining, which is one of my favourite films, and a very sinister opening, creepy opening scene that she composed this very eerie sound for. And we watched The Shining a lot in lockdown.
Oh, you didn't. Sinead.
I know, if you're like a writer stuck in a place that you can't leave with your family, going slowly mad trying to write, I was like, maybe I shouldn't be watching The Shining over and over. But it was because of Carlos's wonderful score, which is, I mean, she worked with Stanley Kubrick. She worked with them on Clockwork Orange. She did the music for the original Tron. Like, if you wanted weird electronic synth music, she was the person to go to. And yet, you know, she isn't talked about in the same breath as like Kraftwerk or Brian Eno or anybody else who might happen to be male and maybe a little bit more high profile. But yeah, so I probably was a bad idea watching The Shining.
Yeah,
you all survived anyway.
You came out the other end.
There was no Rome instance, and there's no one
frozen out in a maze in the garden.
No, absolutely not.
did your experience of lockdown, I mean, was that, do you suspect, and it's hard to know because I suppose within your own head you don't have a control group, but I mean, was it coloured by your own experience of illness? Because you kind of, as a teenager, you know, illness and isolation were not necessarily new to you, if we put it that way.
No, absolutely. And it's funny, I did a lot of Zoom book festival events, and a lot of people wanted to talk about the body, because in Constellations I talk about the idea, the first line of the book is, you know, the body is an afterthought. You don't think about your own body until something terrible happens to it. And a lot of people, I think, were having first encounters with illness or fear around illness or fear of getting sick or hospitalization or knowing somebody close to them who got very seriously ill or people who died. So I think a lot of us start thinking about our bodies, our mortality, what might happen if something terrible, if COVID was to visit one of our homes or one of our relatives. So I did a lot of talking about that at the time, because I think it was some people's first experience and a lot of people were very afraid. And there was also that sense, you know, things that happened to me were very singular and just happened to me. But remember, we all thought, like, you don't know who's, it was kind of a leveler. You didn't know everyone could potentially get it. So we were all very much in this awful kind of leaky boat together, thinking, I hope it's not me, you know, pre-vaccines and pre all that time. But yeah, it made me, but also, like, I've been freelance for years and I'm a writer, and writers, what do? They sit in their room in a room most of the time. So the isolation wasn't hard. I mean, I think, like everybody, if you children, it was tricky being at home and everybody trying to get on the Wi-Fi at the one time. And
I never
want to go back there.
No, enough of that. But you use the phrase mortality. I mean, you because I read a pre-COVID interview with you where you were talking about your own kind of acute sense of your own mortality that you would have had post cancer diagnosis and treatment, I guess. That's where that came from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I got leukemia in my late 20s, and it was a very serious kind. It was very sudden, very acute. And I had presented with a lung clot. And so again, COVID was not great for me. I had some lung scarring from that old clot. And I remember my husband didn't tell me till years later that he said to me, they did literally tell me to prepare myself. It wasn't looking very good because I had a lot of other complications. But I did, I came through it, and I wrote in Constellations, like, that the night my parents were going to come in, I'd gone in an ambulance, and they were going to, I couldn't face telling them. I just couldn't look in my mother's face and tell her, they've just told me something awful and I don't want to tell you. And I tried to think of something to say. And again, I don't remember this. And I do believe that the brain blocks out traumatic and kind of dark moments. And she said to me when I was working in Constellations, she said, do you remember what you said to me in the hospital? And I said, I don't. I remember I wanted the nurse to tell you because I just couldn't face telling you. So the nurse did tell them. And then when she walked in and came around the curtain, I said, I'm not going to die. I'm going to write a book. Because I just felt I had to give her something or make her think that I was okay. Of course, I wasn't okay. I was terrified. But if I told her that and I seemed okay, maybe we'd all, that, you know, fake it till you make it kind of thing. But yeah, a really dark time. But I, you know, I've I recovered and I have had children since, and I feel like, but I'm always aware of it. I think of it, you know, a lot. You know,
How does that inform you and life choices? I see, I'm still, I think I'll live forever on some level.
We all
you know
do.
What I mean?
Yeah.
And the voice that says you won't, I just, I've thus far I've been successful at silencing
that voice. Absolutely. I mean, I go back to hematology in James's. I have a wonderful professor who came to the book launch, and I thank him in the book. He's just so lovely, Paul Brown. And every time I go back in there for that blood test, I do have that moment when I walk through the door going, this is the day they're going to go, because your counts are a little bit down, or there's something not quite right. So you never can get complacent or forget it, or if anything else ever goes on, I try, weirdly, I'm the opposite of a hypochondriac. I literally won't go to the doctor if I think there's something wrong now, and that it's not that I've the fear, it's just that I've said before, illness is very, very boring. It's an interruption to your life, and it disrupts your life, and it takes you away from, you know, your job or your family or going on holidays or whatever it is. And therefore, I think I almost kind of avoid the idea of illness. I mean, I wouldn't be stupid and not go about something. But yeah, I think I've got the illness quota between the leukemia and the hip replacement and stuff. I'm like, okay, that's enough now. I'm all set on the illness front. But I was only talking to somebody at the festival yesterday saying that if you've never spent a night in hospital, I think you're one of the luckiest people in the world. And nobody thinks about that. Again, we don't think about these things we take for granted all the time. So health is a huge, huge asset and a privilege, I think.
Yeah, it's probably human nature that we don't. I mean, I'm not sure
because
we would get out. We wouldn't go out and live our lives.
No,
if
it's too
frightening
to think about. Yeah, absolutely.
But listen, you were at that festival. I suppose that you were talking, I'm sure, about Constellations. The context that conversation came up in, but also this woman's work. And I'm holding it in my hand. I mentioned the Fatima Bhutto. You mentioned plenty of others as well. There's lots of little great reads in it, I mean, you talk about the flexibility in editing a collection of essays. There's great flexibility in reading it as well, which is something I have to say I love. And you're going to be talking about it in Burris at the Literary Festival?
Yes, the wonderful Donal Deneen is going to be interviewing me. I was a massive fan of his radio show and his music, so it'll be great to have a conversation with him.
Oh, well, you can test your meeting your heroes.
I'm telling you, he'll be lovely, I know you will.
Philosophy. Once again, listen, Sinead, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for coming in.
A total pleasure. Thanks for the chat.
And we mentioned the festival in Burris. festivalofwritingandideas.com is the website. Sinead's interview with Donal Deneen about this woman's work, her new collection of essays, is on the Saturday, but there's lots happening and you can get tickets there.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With Nissan.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.